I would like to announce our 10-minute speaker, Tom C. from Porterville.
Good morning, everyone. My name's Tom. I'm an alcoholic. Thank God for that. I've never found the life I found had it not been for alcohol. So I'm grateful alcoholic. I'm grateful for every drink I took, because without it, it would have never done to me what made me willing to listen. An Indian proverb says, listen lest thy mouth deafen thee. You know, and I finally learned how to listen when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, it's funny, I was thinking this morning, a lot of my friends lately up here have been asked to speak somewhere. I'm thinking, how come they never asked me to speak? And somebody told me this morning, because you talk too long. But then last night they asked me to be a 10-minute speaker. I don't want to do that. You know, it's part of that insecurity in there, I guess, whatever. That confusion that's still resting me. I'm very privileged to be here today, because the speaker today, we go back 31 years. I got sober down in the San Fernando Valley, 1979. In fact, I just celebrated my 31st birthday about a week ago. And through no virtue on my part. And he was one of the pillars, what I call the pillars of Alcoholics Anonymous. He was one of several men who always talked the program and stuff. And I never talked to him a lot, but the first thing I remembered when I heard he was going to speak is that I was pretty new, and the Valley Club where I got sober, you could go there and sit there all day long. And I thought, boy, if I could just come here and sit here all day long, I'd get well. And I was talking to Don. I said, I was looking for some way to be able to do that, you know. And he said, you got somebody to pay your bills? I said, well, no. He said, then get your ass to work. It was not the answer I was looking for. But you know what? I got my ass to work. Which leads me to what I was thinking about lately, because a lot of you know that I've been on chemotherapy for about 3 months, and the side effects are kicking my butt, you know. And so I haven't been going to as many meetings as I usually go to, but I do go to some. And somebody have said, God, it's so nice to see you. You don't feel good. You show up at meetings anyway. And I said, I don't go to the meetings. I said, they're where I go to get healed. It's about self-centeredness, you know. Rid of our problems, selfish self-centeredness. When I was newly sober, when I finally about a year into the sobriety, why? It goes back to the thing he told me about, you get your ass to work, you know. When I did my first real inventory, I made my grudge list, 86 people on the list. And I realized that I had decided how everybody's supposed to do things. And God, that's what self-centeredness means. Because I thought it meant I was stingy and I didn't share my stuff and so on. But no, I'm trying to run the world, you know. But I couldn't get out of that, you know, that. They kept getting out of self, get out of self, get out. How the hell do you get out of self? You know, I'm in here, I can't get out. And what he told me, he says, when he said that, you know, go, you know, get your ass to work. And finally, one day I was a cabinet maker. So, you know, I'm shoving a piece of board through the saw. You have to pay attention so you don't cut your fingers off. And it dawned on me, he said, you know, as long as I'm shoving that board through the saw, I'm not thinking about me. And when I'm not thinking about me, I'm just fine, you know. And that's why I come to these meetings. I come here to get healed, because I tell you what, when I'm physically ill, it's like I've got this neon sign that's flashing on and off of the big arrow. Says, me, 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 me. It's all I can think about, you know, because of the physical discomfort. So I come to the meetings because I listen to other people share, and I become part of your story, you know. I listen to you. He was saying this morning, he says, I joined a fellowship, not a program, you know. And that's what it's about. I can't believe, I don't think I deserve it, but all the care and the love and the attention I've gotten lately, because people know what I'm going through, I don't understand it. You know, I don't think I'm worth it, you know. Wednesday night, there was about 18 people there, and they were singing happy birthday to you. And when it got to the part where it says, Happy birthday, dear Tom. And I'm going, happy birthday, you piece of shit. You know? There's that, still that negative thing in me that doesn't believe I'm worth something, but AA said, no, you are worth something. You know? Because I had a PhD in negativity, let's look at it that way, what I got here. And you tell me what you want to do, and I'll tell you 43 reasons why you can't do it, you know. And they tell me, Tom, make a gratitude list. I said, so I make the list. Life still sucks. Why waste my time, you know? I was one of the, in fact, they told me this is a positive program for negative people, and I was a very, very, very negative people. And thankfully, most of that's been taken away, but obviously some of it still exists in there. But I have I don't know how many of you are new in here, but you know, it tells me in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous that as an alcoholic, I can go on to the bitter end, you know, making the best out of life that I can possibly make, or I can accept spiritual help. And then later it says, you know, making that decision is not an easy decision to make. And today I say, why isn't it? You know, because I've learned what the blessings of practicing this program have brought me. But it is about getting out of self and being concerned with the thoughts of others. When I read in the big book, my original book, I'll tell you a funny story about my original book. It's totally destroyed. It's all dirty and falling apart. And there was a guy over at my house one day, and we were talking program, and I went to get my book, and I'm looking at this thing, and I think, boy, if I take it out there, he'll really be impressed. So I took my new book out, sure, but self-centeredness is still there. But like I said, these spiritual principles have been around forever. You know, they're for everybody. And the thing that I am grateful about alcohol for is because I would have never been able to hear them with the mindset I had. Never been able to hear it. And that's why that alcohol made me willing to listen. It made me willing to take a suggestion from somebody besides, guess who? Me, you know. I was a self-possessed person. I had all the answers. And my life sucked, and I couldn't understand why, you know. And so Don has been a real, real important. He's got a memory like a library. He remembers everybody. And it's interesting, but I got to ask him, well, what about so-and-so? What about so-and-so? What about so-and-so? And every one of them that I mentioned never got drunk again. They passed away, a lot of them. A lot of them are still sober. And like one fellow that, Al, I guess he doesn't care about his anonymity now. But he died with 60 years sober. You know, 60 years sober. So, he's a grouchy old guy, but there were a lot of grouchy old guys when I got sober. But they didn't, you know, my sponsor that I finally got, in fact, he said he even talked to him a few weeks ago, and I haven't talked to him in 20 years. But I got new sponsors up here. But I just lost my train of thought. You know what? I've probably been talking long enough. That'll make Jean Marie happy. She was telling me. But you know, they told me when somebody asks a question, throw as much crap through the window as you can before they slam it shut, you know. So I always have a lot to say. I don't know if it makes any sense, but today it's just trying to be a service, trying to help, trying to lighten the load for somebody else like you lightened the load for me, you know. I'm grateful to every one of you. You are my family. I'm closer to you than I've ever been close to my own family. Except maybe my mom. Fortunately, I have three sisters, and my mother couldn't take care of herself anymore, and we got together as a family and said, okay, each one of us will go over once a week, take her to the store and so on. Well, my three sisters all bailed out, so I ended up doing it all. And at the time I was grumpy, but later I saw, you know, I got to know my wife, my mother as a woman, rather than my mother. Again, a great gift of sobriety, because had it not been sober, I'd have never gone there. Never. And these are the blessings, these subtle things that happen and you don't realize till afterwards what a great gift this thing is. What a great gift. You don't have to do anything to earn it, anything to get it. It's free for the taking. All I had to do is follow a few simple suggestions. I didn't want to, but I didn't have a choice. It was do it or die. And to me, that's what the disease of alcoholism is all about. You got to do it or die. Because it'll take you. It'll take everything. And again, I'm grateful to all of you for being here and putting up with me for 10 minutes. And finally giving me a chance to speak. Now, you don't have to. You don't have to ask me to do it again. And I guess we take a break now for 10 minutes, and then we'll have Don C. Sharing about his experience at Strength and Hope. Thank you.
At this time, I would like to introduce our main speaker, Don C. from West Hills.
Well, before I get started, is there anyone here from the press, radio, or films taking notes for tomorrow morning's paper? Good. My name is Don Crandall, and I'm an alcoholic. And before I forget, I'd like to thank whoever it was on the committee and Julie for inviting me up here to do what I'm supposed to do this morning. It's always a privilege to participate in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm happy to say that I'm glad to see that AA is alive and well in Springville, California. More importantly, thank you all for being here. If this were just a meeting between Julie and I, wouldn't have been much. So thank you for being here. My home group is the West Valley Participation Group that meets on Monday night in Northridge, California. It's a relatively new group. August the 16th of this month, we will celebrate our 64th anniversary. Started in 1946. And I had the privilege of sitting in meetings with some of the men who were in the original group. As a matter of fact, in Alcoholics Anonymous, there are literally thousands of characters. In that particular group, we had a character whose name was Mike Z. He's now dead about 13 years. Mike came to Alcoholics Anonymous when he was 58 years old. He died with 49 years of sobriety. He was 107. And up until the last 3 weeks before he died, he attended meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. There was something else that was relevant about Mike. Mike never read the book, Alcoholics Anonymous. He was a Romanian immigrant, and he never learned to read English. And we used to ask him, we'd say, Mike, how did you get this? How did you get the program? He said, I put the book underneath my pillow. Made sense to me. Anyway, I came to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, June the 28th, 1967. It hasn't been necessary, nor have I, taken a drink of alcohol or any other mind-bending chemical from that day until this. So if anybody's mathematically challenged, I just turned 43. I put that qualifier in there because I like to tell a story about the guy who comes to Alcoholics Anonymous, and he's been sitting in the audience for 8 or 9 months with his wife, and he gets up and he says, you know, since I came to AA, has it been necessary for me to take a drink? He sat down, and his beautiful Al-Anon wife jarred him right between her ribs. She said, you were drunk last week. He said, that's true, but it wasn't necessary. As it was with Tom, and as it is with many of us in Alcoholics Anonymous, laughter is a great healer. It's a great healer for those of us in AA. We learn to laugh with, and then we learn to laugh at, and then we learn to laugh at ourselves. And it's a great healer in AA. There is a line in the book Alcoholics Anonymous that's most misquoted of any line that I know. We read it today. We disclose in a general way what we were like, what happened, and what we are like today. Most people use the word it. It's we. One of the things that I like to know is if I'm with we today. So let me give you a little deal that I go through. I started drinking probably in my teenage years when after athletic events at the local high school. I came from a little town 100 miles north of New York City. We used to adjourn to a little pizzeria place where you could get a pizza for a dollar. You could get an 8-ounce glass of beer for 10 cents. Or you could get a quart of beer for 35 cents. Or you could get 3 quarts of beer for a dollar. Oh, I am with my people. Which ones did you opt for? How many of you skipped the pizza? I'm with my people. You understand what I'm talking about. Every athlete I've ever known is always looking for the edge. That's part of our makeup. And so I am with my people. I came to that first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in a manner of which I've not heard in the years that I've been here. By the way, we didn't have any newcomers this morning, but those that didn't raise their hands on our new, welcome. But anyway, how I came to Alcoholics Anonymous was that I was working for a company out of Valparaiso, Indiana. And I was in their office in Palo Alto, California. And on June the 28th, they came out and fired me. And the reason that they fired me was because of my alcoholism. Now, their idea of what was wrong with me and my idea of what was wrong with me did not coincide. But that's what they did. Now, what they did next was almost unheard of. They called Alcoholics Anonymous in downtown San Jose, because that was the city I lived in, and asked the man down there to call me on the phone. And I didn't know how they knew how to do that for a long time. And eventually I was to come to find out that we had a man in the sales organization that I was in at that time who had been a bad drunk in Chicago. And he had gone to Alcoholics Anonymous and he had been sober for 5 years. So through his example and the 11th tradition based on attraction rather than promotion, I suspect that he directed the two men that fired me to a chapter in the book Alcoholics Anonymous entitled Two Employers. Because that's exactly the directions that they followed. I talked to that man, and he ended it with the $64,000 question. He told me what his life had been like, what had happened to him, and what his life was like that day. What he didn't tell me was that he was in a wheelchair. But he asked me the question, would you like to go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous tonight? He didn't want to talk about tomorrow night. He wanted to talk about tonight. And since things weren't going extremely well that day, I opted to go to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, Johnny, I lived in the southwest corner of San Jose, and Johnny sent me to the northeast corner of Santa Clara. about a 14-mile run. And he told me to look for a guy named Bill Leopold. And I didn't know anything about Alcoholics Anonymous, but I knew I weren't one of them. Because I knew what an alcoholic looked like. And you do too, right? And I look out there today, I don't see any. We used to have a saying, if you can't smell them, you can't tell them. And so, I arrived at my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, dressed very similar to the way I'm dressed today, except on that particular night, which was a Thursday night, I had my $39 Richmond Brothers suit on. I wasn't going to any place without being dressed appropriately. As I said, I didn't know anything about you people. I got to the door of this place, and a guy reached out his hand, and he says, "Welcome." He says, "My name is Eddie. You're new." I said, "How does he know?" I went inside, and there were only 22 people in the meeting, and he knew every one of those, but he didn't know me. I took one look at him. He had a haircut, just exactly the same as the one I have today. And in those days, I had the same haircut. I've had this haircut for longer than I'd like to tell you about. I said, "I don't know what this is all about, but at least this guy knows how to get a haircut." So I went to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I can't tell you what happened at that meeting in the course of the meeting, but I can tell you what happened afterwards. As was prone to happen in those days, about four guys came around and circled me when the meeting was over. And they started asking me questions. And one of the things that I've tried to put a little handle on over the years, I came into Alcoholics Anonymous mouth first. So they were asking me questions, and all of a sudden I was explaining to them what a great I am I was. And the boy with the dashboard overalls wasn't a boy, he was a full-grown man, breaking on a railroad, finally looked down at me because he was taller. He said, "Sonny, if you're so smart, what are you doing here?" And I didn't have the answer. And so he handed me a piece of paper. I remember it today as if it was yesterday. It was salmon in color, and it had a list of the meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous in the Santa Clara Valley on it. And it was only about that tall and folded over. There were no more than 20 meetings. And he said, "I've marked off some X's. Follow the X's and try not to drink." And I said, "Okay." I said, "Will I see you tomorrow?" He said, "I don't know." I said, "What kind of a dummy is this?" And he explained to me that he lived 24 hours at a time, one day. And his day was over when he went to bed that night. And when he got up in the morning, he started over. And he didn't know what his plans were going to be. Needless to say, I saw him at every one of those meetings he marked off. And after I had been to every one of those meetings that he marked off, I still had a telephone. He called me and he says, "Hey, Don, you want to go to a meeting?" And that two-watt bulb that we have on our heads, it went off. And it said, "Where's this guy been when I'm trying to find meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous?" Because they weren't on every street corner in those days. And then I realized that what he wanted to know was I willing? And it was the same reason that Johnny sent me 14 miles across town. Because I was to later find out that there was a meeting I could have walked to around the corner. But Johnny wanted to find out if I was willing. Hound Dog Jim wanted to find out if I was willing. And when I became willing, they became willing. And that's the way I work with people today. Only I try to do it on a shortcut basis because I ask one simple question. Do you want to stop drinking? And if the answer doesn't come back in the affirmative, I don't need to spend too much time. Because if you don't want to stop drinking, and you're sitting in a room of Alcoholics Anonymous, you're probably wasting your time and ours both. So what happened was that as I was traveling through these meetings, it was suggested to me that if I wanted to know whether or not I was an alcoholic, maybe I ought to go back and take a look at my life and see where alcohol had taken me, what alcohol had done to me, and what alcohol had done for me. Now, I am not aware of your situation, but I know mine. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I had been feeding myself the same BS for so long that I believed it. And I could not be honest with myself. I could not be open-minded. And least of all, I was unwilling to do anything about my changing anything in my life. However, God in His infinite wisdom granted me a grace period so that I could go back over my life and take a look and see what had happened. And as I reviewed it, I'll tell you some of the interesting things. I came out of high school in 1952, right in the middle of something called the Korean conflict. Not too many of you in the room remember that. But in the Korean conflict, if you had grades to go to college, and you could maintain your grades in college, they would let you complete the college, and then they would see whether or not they needed you in the armed forces. And if they did need you in the armed forces, they had something called a GI Bill, and you could further your college education or whatever you wanted to do. Now, I am an alcoholic, and I don't know too many alcoholics that don't have the two words that I'm going to talk about next. One of those is pride, and the other is fear. And I had grades that I could have gone to any college I wanted to. However, my fear said, you probably won't be able to maintain your grades. And my pride said, what will people think? You know how many people there were worried about that? One. Me. And so, I did the only thing that we Alkies know how to do. I came up with a plan. Every Alkie I know has a plan. You already know that I've established the fact that I'm looking for the edge. So I enlisted in the United States Navy. Now, if I'd have gone in the Army, I probably would have been in for 2 years. If I go in the Navy, I'm going to be in there for four. Wrong. I enlisted before I was 18, which meant that I was to get out the day before I was 21. And guess what day I was inducted in the United States Navy? June the 28th, 1952. Does that sound familiar? I had that down to where I was going to do 3 years and 16 days in the Navy. However, if you're an Alkie and you have a plan, you know what happens to the plans. Exactly. I am I'm on board a ship in Norfolk, Virginia. The executive officer comes up to me and he says, Crandall, have you taken these academic courses in high school? And I said, yes to all of them. And he said, okay. He said, based on your GCT and your basic battery test, you qualify to take the examination to go to the United States Naval Academy Preparatory School in Bainbridge, Maryland. And I thought to myself for a second, and I made one of those great alcoholic monumental decisions. I said, Bainbridge, Maryland is 278 miles from my home versus about 378 here in Norfolk, Virginia. And when I get back in New York State, I can drink legally and I don't have to be ducking around the corners like I'm doing down here. And I said, yes. And then, of course, I followed up, how much work am I going to get out of? Because we're not prone to that. He said, 2 days. I said, certainly, I'll take the exam. I took the exam, and I passed, and I was transferred to Bainbridge, Maryland. Now, you notice that I made the decision to take that exam on two things. One was to get out of work. Two was to get close to a place where I could drink legally. I think that's described as an obsession. I got into a place in Bainbridge, Maryland, and we used to travel by air. Not the air you people are familiar with. This was hitchhiking. Air, you go my way. And on a good night, I could come out of Bainbridge, Maryland, and be home within 6 hours. But some of the nights though, that the itinerary took me through one of the two tunnels in New York, and I was in New York, and I would stop and have a drink. Many nights I got through all right. And then there was the nights when I started to drink on Friday night, and the next thing I knew was Sunday morning. And I had to return to the naval station. And all the time I was drinking, I believe that qualifies for the physical allergy or the phenomena of craving. Because once I started drinking, I didn't know when I was going to stop. So I have both of the things that qualify me as an alcoholic. The phenomena of craving and the obsession. I can give you some more examples of this thing as I'm going through. I was appointed to the United States Naval Academy. Now, every one of us in this room knows about certain things. In the Naval Academy, they have rules. But all of us in this room know that the rules do not apply to us. All of us in this room know if there are rules, there are ways to break them. And so it was with me in the Naval Academy. The Naval Academy, there's two words in the English language that most of us who are alcoholics don't like. And one of those is authority, and the other one is discipline. Going to the United States Naval Academy, not liking authority or discipline, is not a good idea. Because that's what that place is all about. But I can confirm the obsession to drink. Part of the rules at the Naval Academy was no drinking within 10 miles of the chapel tower, and you couldn't go outside of 8 miles of the chapel tower. Somebody's ahead of me. That didn't apply to me. I found a way to do that. I also found a way to get out at night and go drinking within the confines of Washington and Baltimore, full well knowing that if it was ever apprehended, it was automatic dismissal. By the way, I went to the Naval Academy not wanting to be a naval officer, and I figured it wouldn't hurt me. So, everything is going fine until 2 weeks before graduation. My buddy and I are apprehended by the Annapolis Police Department. We'd been out drinking. Now, how he knew we were from the Naval Academy, I have no idea. We had spit-shine shoes. We had perfectly creased navy blue trousers. We had the white shirts without the collar, but we were camouflaged. We had hunting jackets, black and white. And I had a haircut just like this. How did that guy know we were from the Naval Academy? We were thrown in the Annapolis jail. I cried like a baby because I knew it was all over. All that macho stuff that we alcoholics have when the shades are really down, we're very human. But anyway, we're taken back by the Annapolis Police Department to the gate of the Naval Academy. The guy who was to take my buddy and I in recognized my buddy George from a fraternal organization that they both belonged to. He dismissed the Annapolis policeman. He had a talk with George. George came over to me and said, "Let's get back in the rack. Got to get back in the room." And I said, "What did he say?" He said, Jimmy Legs wasn't going to turn us in. Now, when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was having problems with God. God had been working in my life long before I realized it. And that was one of the indications. Because of my obsession to drink, I was willing to give up that education I had and right up until the end when I graduated from the Naval Academy. One of the other words that we don't like in our vocabulary, and every one of us has been in a situation with our families, our friends, our ministers, employers, and they've all said the same thing. You know, if you didn't drink, you have such potential. God, did I hate that. But let's look at it. How many of us in this room have thrown away experiences, situations, all kinds of things just to get a drink? And I don't think there's one of us that can't talk about that. One of the ones I wanted to talk about is I had an opportunity to go to flight training in Pensacola, Florida. It's a naval base down there where they train pilots. And I was in that flight training school, and the other thing that I know about we who are alcoholics is that we can be on good behavior for prescribed amounts of time. Unfortunately, we don't know how long they're going to be. And so I was on good behavior through early stages of flight training, and then I started to drink, and maybe you'll identify with this one. I was in a bar one night, and I was having a couple of drinks, and I knew I was going to go up in an airplane the next day, and I was going to do acrobatic maneuvers to see if I qualified to move on to the next phase of my training. And I had a couple of drinks, and I said, "Well, he won't get to me till 9 or 10 o'clock. I'll be okay." Had a couple more drinks. I said, "He won't get to me until the afternoon. I'll be okay." And a couple of more drinks. Who cares? And so it was, and I don't know how much I drank that night, but I know I had a capacity to drink pretty good volumes in those days. I was 22, 23 years old. But anyway, then the next morning I hit the flight line at the waiting field in Milton, Florida. 7 o'clock in the morning, a Marine captain rolls up. Yeah, exactly. "Let's go, Crandall." I got a belly full of booze. I'm hungover real bad. And we're going up in this T-28 aircraft. And we're going to do everything with that airplane you can do except crash it. And that's exactly what we did. The other thing I know about us who are alcoholics, we can do a lot of things by rote. And I was able to do all of those things by rote, including the last maneuver, which we call the half Cuban eight. You started here, and you rolled up on top, rolled her over, and you came down, and you were upside down. You had to roll it out and flatten it up. And I did all of that. And the Marine captain said, "Take her home." And I muttered the famous words, "I don't know where I am." That was the end of my flight training career. And you know what I thought? I'll tell you what I thought. I said, "You guys have just wiped out the greatest naval ace ever to come down the pipe." Not too egotistical, huh? And I had to go back to sea. But one more time, the obsession to drink. And I did it full well knowing what I was going to have to do the next day. I went back to sea. I went back on destroyers. Naval officers in general are real intelligent guys, except the ones on my ship. They elected me the wardroom mess treasurer. Now, the word treasurer means I was dealing with money. That's all you need to know. right? I've got their money. I'm supposed to pay the supply officer. That obsession hit one night. I decided I needed to drink more than they needed to eat. And I went ashore with their money and started drinking. The other thing that I know about us who are alcoholics, we're creatures of habit. When they discovered that the money was gone and I was gone, they came looking for me. Took them exactly 3 bars and they had me. So I was subject to a court-martial and I'd been in other trouble. And I was finally sent to a shore billet, Treasure Island in San Francisco. By this time, I'm writing bad checks. I'm a paper hanger. And I got so bad that I was writing bad checks on a naval base, and finally the commanding officer came in and called and told me straight out. He said, Crandall, by this time I had achieved the rank of full lieutenant, which is 03. And he said, you either resign for the good of the naval service, or I'm going to ship your butt to the Portsmouth Naval Prison. It didn't take long to make that decision. I knew the naval prison at Portsmouth was probably run by Marines. And that's not good news. So I opted to resign for the good of the naval service. And in the military, when they bring you in from one place, they always have to get you back to the same place. And so I had a ticket back to, and a bus ticket back to that little town in upstate New York. Now, what would any self-respecting drunk do with that? Exactly. I turned it into money, and I started drinking. I was thrown out of the Navy November the 10th, 1961. By the end of November, I lay at the corner of 3rd and Howard Streets in San Francisco with a wine bottle in my pocket and an old pair of navy blue trousers, beat-up pair of navy shoes, a navy overcoat with no buttons on it, because the commanding officer wanted nothing to identify me as ever having been a naval officer. I think he was a little bit fried. And there I was, the perfect picture of what I thought an alcoholic looked like. Yet the night that I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I either could not or would not bring that picture to my brain. And Tom said, when he was talking, that I have a rather good memory, and it's true. But because of my alcoholism and the way we can operate, I was able to black that out until I started looking at it. And when I was able to look at that, I was well on the way to fully conceding to my innermost self that I am indeed an alcoholic. I'd like to tell you that it was immediate that I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, it's 6 more years. And I did the old roller coaster ride that we do. I finally got back home via the U.S. rail system without the benefit of ticket. And my family didn't know what to do with me. My dad got me into something called the electronics business. And I went to work and I got on good behavior again for a prescribed amount of time. Got myself promoted to an outside sales job. That's the alcoholic's dream. You got an expense account, you got a car, and you're away from the office. And in those days, there were no cell phones. So if you stayed away from the telephone, they couldn't find you. And how many of those receipts did I turn in that I'd never been in that motel? I'd never bought a meal for that person. I just hammered that expense account to get drinking money. And eventually that caught up with me. I got fired, I had to find another job, and that's when I went to work for a company out of Valparaiso, Indiana. And then it was where I came to California and amassed 3 drunken driving charges. One of those was drunken driving on private property. That's not easy to do. I think in the penal code in those days, it was known as 647F. What happened was I pulled into the liquor store. Before I got there, it was a regular liquor store. After I got there, it was a drive-in liquor store. The guy who owned it had a son for a lawyer. He was there before the cops. That was one of them. Another one was, I really didn't deserve the last DUI that I got. No, serious. In those days, I was smoking cigars. And I'd been out, and I hadn't had a lot to drink. I maybe had 7, 8, 10 beer. That's not a lot when I was drinking. But anyway, I'm coming down the El Camino in Mountain View, California, and there's a stoplight. And I stopped, and there's 6 cars in front of me. And I dropped the cigar. I don't know how it fell out of my mouth. But it fell out of my mouth and hit the floor. So when I reached over to pick up the cigar, my foot slipped off the brake, hit the gas, and I rear-ended all 6 of them. You know, if I hadn't been smoking cigars, I would have never been in that problem. That's how we alcoholics think. I told you we could do things by rote. I got through the field sobriety test. And the guy handed me a piece of paper, put me over against the wall, and he said, write down what happens. Did you ever have alcoholic paralysis? That's what happened to me. I couldn't write. And I know now why I couldn't write. Because when they drew my blood and they came back 0.4, that's why I couldn't write. And I hadn't had a lot to drink, but I had enough to drink in my system over the days prior to that incident. And that was my last drunken driving offense in California. And I stood in front of a judge in Palo Alto for that offense and the drunken driving on private property. And he read off a litany. $786 in fine. You're going to do 5 days in the county jail. You can do it on a weekend. I'm going to give you 30 days sentence, which will be suspended if you stay within bounds over a period of 1 year. I'm revoking your driver's license. That didn't bother me. The license I had wasn't any good anyway. He said, you're going to do summary probation for 1 year while you pay off this fine. And he said, you're either going to go to Alcoholics Anonymous or an alcoholic rehabilitation clinic. That was the only time I'd ever heard of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that was on May the 23rd of 1967. I spent the next 35 days trying to prove that Judge Sidney A. Feinberg did not know what he was talking about. And finally, I came to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I've had the good fortune to be able to stay here ever since. Why is it that I have been able to stay? I believe that there are some things that we have to do. In chapter 5, we read how it works. The next chapter is called Into Action. It's not called Into Meetings. It's called Into Action. And so I had learned that I had to do some things in order to maintain this sobriety. At the tail end of what we read in the portion of chapter 5, it talks about God could and would if he were sought. That's true. But God is not going to do anything for me that I can't do for myself. And I have to participate or be cooperative with my God in order for this thing to work for me. I cannot come here, sit in a meeting, and by some sort of osmosis, I'm going to be struck sober. It's not going to happen. It's about the same chance as me going sitting in a chicken coop and becoming a chicken. It ain't going to happen. So what I found out was that I was going to have to do some things. I was able to fully concede to my innermost self that I was an alcoholic. And I made a tactical error one night. I said to a guy, you know, I got the first half of that first step. I said, but I don't think my life is unmanageable. He said, if it's not, why do you have a probation officer? Didn't have a clue. So here I am. I'm in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I don't know what I'm supposed to do, but I'd like to tell you that I wasn't able to come to that conclusion in the first 15 minutes that I was in AA. Because I couldn't get honest enough. couldn't get open-minded enough, and I couldn't be willing enough to get all of that that I just told you in a few minutes together. It took time. And once I was able to fully concede to my innermost self that I'm an alcoholic and my life is unmanageable, that's fine. There's another trick question. What do you want to do about it? And if you don't want to do anything about it, you're wasting your time again. If you want to do something about it, we have a way. We have a way that's up and out. It's called the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. And you need the whole thing. I listen to people talk about today, I finished my 12 steps. Let me give you a clue. Newsflash. I'm 43 years sober. I'm not finished with the 12 steps. I will never be finished with the 12 steps. I have a book. I think it's on page 25. It says, and now we pick up a kit of spiritual tools. And we'll be rocketed into a fourth dimension of existence of which we have never dreamed. Now, if somebody can tell me where I'm in that book, it tells me I can put those tools down. Please address me after this meeting. I haven't found it yet. And so what I did was I became involved in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I learned to start putting the 12 steps into my life. And why did I do that? I didn't do it because I wanted to be a good guy. I did that so that they wouldn't have to drink. And what does that have to do with not drinking? What it has to do with not drinking is that in order for me not to drink, I have to learn to live a spiritual way of life, which gives me a daily reprieve from drinking. And I cannot let up on those, on my laurels. I can't rest on my laurels. I can't let up. I've got to do it every day. I told you I had a problem with God when I came in here. Let me tell you about that. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous and I watched all the people who were talking about God. Came up with some brilliant conclusions. First of all, you had blue hair. You had gray hair. You had no hair at all. And you were on the wrong side of 50. You needed God. You were on a way out. Didn't apply to me. I got gray hair. On the wrong side of 50, and I'm not on a way out, and I know of them, but I have a God today. And I have a God today as a result of becoming involved with the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I have a God today because I watched people who have a God in their lives, and I saw that it worked for them. And once I saw that it worked for them, I tried one little bit for me, and it worked. So I gave it a little more. And eventually I came to an understanding of God, which is described in the spiritual experience as having tapped an unsuspected inner resource, which most of us choose to call God. And so I found out that I had to be in concert with God, and I had to do the things that were in His way of life for me. The book Alcoholics Anonymous refers to it as I had to find a new employer. And that employer was God. And how do I know what's God's will and what's my will? I asked that question one night. A little short lady told me. She said, if you don't want to do it, it's God's will. If you want to do it, it's yours. Put me in good stead. That little lady is dead now. But that's what worked for me. You know, we become involved in the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm talking about how do you get done with them? I don't get done with them. How can you ever make the amends to your children and the people around you by just going up and talking to them? To me, making amends is I quit doing those rotten things that I was doing prior to coming to Alcoholics Anonymous. And in order for me to live a spiritual life, I have to do things differently. I was not able to make amends to my family by just saying, oh, I'm sober. Ain't that great? No, I had to do things for my family until he died. I have to do things for my children, which they don't want me to do. But if they wanted me to do them, I'm there and ready to do it. I hear people talk about you got to do the steps in order. When the IRS man came to my door, I tried to tell him I wasn't on step 9. He didn't want to hear about it. Let me try this. The day that we came to Alcoholics Anonymous and we didn't drink, that day and the day after, we started making amends, if to no one else, but to society in general. Can you imagine what the CHP would have on 190 if all of us were drinking today and when we left this meeting? They'd have a field day. But because we're sober, they don't have to worry about it. We start showing up at home when we're supposed to. We start doing things such as if we say we're going to do them, we make a commitment, and we show up. As a matter of fact, I'll give you a little example of that. I'm leaving Tuesday afternoon to go to Canada to go to work. And the reason that I'm leaving Tuesday is because I had this commitment today. The guy that I'm going to go up there to go to work for wanted me up there last week. And I said, no, I can't go. He said, why not? I said, I made a commitment a long time ago to some people in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm not going to leave them in the lurch. I'm going to go there and do what it is I have to do, and I'll see you when I get up there. And so it is that I'm going Tuesday instead of last week. When we become involved with the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, they become an integral part of our lives. They're not something that we use haphazardly, but they become automatic. Every one of us knows when we're going against the grain. Every one of us knows right from wrong. That doesn't mean that we don't do it. All it means that we know. And so we have to take these steps and put them into our lives. Let me give you another one. I have character defects and I have shortcomings, and I still have them today. Let me tell you that I'm still working on them. One of the ones I told you about, I came in here mouth first. I try to tone it down a little bit. Making some progress. And that's what we do. Now, all of this goes together to make what we know is that we've got a God. We're starting to improve the way that we live. We're not carrying on the way that we used to. And we're starting to live a spiritual way of life. In the 12 and 12, on page 99, there is a prayer by a guy named St. Francis of Assisi. And that prayer is a good aid to live in a spiritual way of life. And I try to use that prayer. As a matter of fact, I read it every day. And that's another thing that's strange. I read from the book Alcoholics Anonymous every day. Yet I cannot memorize the things that I read every day. But what is read in the meetings, I have memorized. I don't have it memorized. Let me put it a different way. I don't have it memorized, but don't make a mistake. Because it bangs on my ear. Now, everyone knows about the promises on page 83 and 84, right? Right? There's another promise at the bottom of 84 and the top of 85, which is much more important to me. May not be to you. But that promise is that when I quit fighting everyone and everything, or anyone and anybody, I become placed in a position of neutrality. I no longer think about drinking. It's not part of my psyche. How does it happen? The book said we don't know. It just happens. Now, people say, well, yeah, that occurs after step 9. I said, yeah, that's right. But I believe that God gives us a grace until we can get to the point where that position of neutrality is in place. As long as we're willing and open-minded and honest. And the other thing that it talks about is this is the miracle. Everyone talks about don't leave 5 minutes before the miracle. What's the miracle? The miracle is that I don't have to think about drinking anymore. It's not part of me. That does not mean that I am not, I repeat, not fully aware that alcohol is still my problem. My thinking will take my thinking and action in a spiritual manner will put the obsession in a place where I don't have to act on it. And if I don't act on it, I don't take a drink, and I don't start the phenomenon of craving. So what I have to do is I have to make sure that the obsession is in check, so I have to do spiritual things every day. And I do the... They're stupid things, some of them. Do you ever walk out of the grocery store and look behind you to see if there's anyone there before you let the door slam? That's a spiritual act. One of the greatest ones for me was when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I used to park right in front of the door. A guy came up to me and said, why do you park in front of the door? I said, because I want to. He said, did you ever think that there might be some people who are elderly that might have handicaps and they need to park near the door because it's tough for them to get to the meeting? He said, are you infirmed? I said, no. He said, then park out. I've been parking out ever since. And I hope you'll park out when I become infirmed. But that's a spiritual thing. Something that we do. Many of us, we did a spiritual thing last night. At least it's spiritual for me. There were a group of us that sat down and broke bread together and talked about things in Alcoholics Anonymous and shared fellowship. And to me, that's spiritual. And what I need to remember is that one of the traditions in Alcoholics Anonymous is the one that you all mumble, and I never saw in the format where it says mumble here. Principles before personalities. Doesn't matter whether I like you or not. What matters is if you're a member of the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, let's sit down and have some fellowship. Let's talk about this thing called Alcoholics Anonymous. I like to laugh in Alcoholics Anonymous, and one of the things that I like to tell you about is that in 1979, I was fortunate enough to go on a cruise with 737 members of Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon. And we went to a place called Mazatlan in Puerto Vallarta in Mexico and came back to Los Angeles. And on that cruise one night, the cruise director decided that we were going to have a scavenger hunt. He was English, so he called it a novel quest. And we all broke up into teams. It was probably 30, 35 on a team. Some of the guys were down playing cards, so they weren't there. And I got on this team, and we got through the whole thing. And he got finished, and he said, okay, and now we're going to have a beauty contest. Don't get ahead of me. Yeah, men dressed up as women. All right, they elected me. I'm an alcoholic. My pride won't let me say no. All right, they take me down. They put me in this muumuu. And then they put a babushka on my head and a hoop earrings and some war paint. And then they gave me a set of heels about that tall. I don't know how you women walk on those yet. Anyway, I'm parading out on this huge dance floor with 30, 35 other guys. And I'm thinking to myself, man, you're looking good. I didn't win. Instant resentment. The guy who won was from the alternate lifestyle. He had a head start. If you'd have told me in any of those 12 years prior to that that I would be involved with such frivolity, I would have given you a one-way ticket to the funny farm. But what it did, it taught me how to laugh at myself. And I didn't even know that there were pictures taken of that until I got home. And then the guy, who was a mailman, Tom, I forgot what his name was, but he brought the pictures in. And I got to take them home with me, and I had them up until the last divorce. She took them with her when she left. But my point is, we never know what's going to happen to us in Alcoholics Anonymous. We don't know what we're going to become involved with. One of the other things that, and I was talking about it yesterday because I was talking about an H&I deal. One of the deals was that they picked me up one night at 6 o'clock downtown San Jose. And I didn't know where I was going. And I got in the back seat, right in the middle, because I was brand new. This was probably late 67, early 68. And I don't know whether you've ever been on one of these H&I deals or not. But they put 5 people in the car. 4 of them are old-timers, and you, the new guy. And you're in the middle of the back seat. And they talk, and you get elbows in the ribs. Because every time one of them makes a point, somebody will jab you. So what happens is that you have a meeting going to the meeting, have a meeting where you are, and you have a meeting coming back from the meeting. And that meeting that night took us into a place that I had never been. I knew it existed. But it was also a place where the first institutional AA was ever done, and it was called San Quentin. And they had the first institutional committee in San Quentin in 1942 because a guy named Warden Duffy thought that Alcoholics Anonymous would be something that would help the inmates at that particular prison. I'll tell you how rigid the conditions were to get into that prison. I got out of the car. We met the guard who was to take us in. And we met the leader from the institutional committee in the San Francisco area by the name of Kim Mixer. And the guard looked at Kim and he said, "You got a new one?" "Yeah." "Is he all right?" "We wouldn't have brought him." "Okay." Next thing I know, the doors are clanking behind me and I'm walking across the yard. So I turned to one of the guys that I came in with. I said, "You know, I don't have anything to tell these people. I've never been in one of these institutions. I don't know what this is all about." He said, "We didn't bring you here for that. We brought you here to show you where you were headed. You didn't stop what you were doing." But as a result of that, I became active in hospital and institution work. I'm not as active as I am, was in the old days, but you ask me to go someplace and I don't have to get a clearance in the next 5 seconds, I'll go. I have no qualms about it. One of the other things that we talk about in Alcoholics Anonymous from time to time is that we don't really know how Alcoholics Anonymous works. Everybody says, "Well, you read chapter 5, it says how it works." I said, "Well, just that's some validity to that statement. But let me give you an analogy which I think how it works." I was standing in the back of the room one night. The guy said, "Would you like to go for ice cream tonight?" I said, "I don't have any money for ice cream." He said, "That wasn't a question." So we went for ice cream, and they bought my ice cream. And pretty soon they found out that I was working for a guy. I was working for a guy because he manufactured a job for me to go to. That's the only reason I was working. And they said, "Okay. Now you're making some money. You can buy your own ice cream." Okay. A few months later, they came to me and said, "You know what your job is next?" "No." He said, "Well, when you get your bills paid and you get straight with the IRS and all of the other crap that you got going on in your life, your job is to go back in to the meeting and find a guy who doesn't have any money for ice cream and start buying his ice cream. I've had the privilege of buying a few gallons of ice cream over the years. As a matter of fact, in the area in which I participate in the fellowship, if ever there's a function, there is no question of who's bringing the ice cream. I always bring it. But my analogy is, when we come into Alcoholics Anonymous, we come in here, there are no lights on, there's nobody home, we can't hit our butt standing in a phone booth, and some guy grabs a hold of us, or gal grabs a hold, and says, come with me. And we take them around and we show them what it is we need to do in Alcoholics Anonymous. And then we turn them loose. And we bump our heads and we bang around. And we grab onto this thing called sobriety. And then what do we have to do? We have to go back in order to repay what we have been so freely given, to find that guy or that gal that has no lights on, nobody home, can't hit their butt standing in the phone booth. And you know what the great fact of all of that is? It's something that the book Alcoholics Anonymous tells us that we should not miss. And that is watching the transformation of that new man or new gal. As they walk through into Alcoholics Anonymous, the lights come on. There's somebody home. They take their rightful place in society. And then you watch them start to help someone else. There's no greater gift that I've ever been given than being able to do that. So I keep doing it. Sometimes I go overboard on it. I don't know. Sometimes I don't read page 96 sometimes. If you don't know what that's about, go home and read it. But I was telling someone the other day, you know, I've got a couple of guys that I've worked with. One of them has 3 years of sobriety. Only took them 18 years to get it. I have another one that I affectionately labeled the director of research. And he now has 4 years of sobriety. It took him 21 to get those. But all of the time that I've been involved with those guys, and I wasn't involved with them every minute of every day. No, I was involved with them when they wanted to participate. When they didn't want to participate anymore, I moved on to somebody else. But the great deal is that when they were ready, as a matter of fact, the guy that has 3 years, he called me on a day that I was suffering from food poisoning. And I took him where he needed to go and got him involved in what he needed to be involved with. And one of the things about being in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's pertinent to this, what I'm talking about. I'm in Kaiser, because this guy's got Kaiser. We're trying to get him checked in. And a guy comes by and he says, oh, Dr. Crandall. He said, what are you doing here? I said, not me. I said, him. Oh, he says, does he have trouble with alcohol, with adult beverages? I said, yeah, Martin, he does. You know, we spun him through a process that normally takes 6 to 8 hours in 1 hour and 15 minutes. I had him in the car. Well, actually, before I had him in the car, he was smoking. So you couldn't smoke in the building we were in. So he went outside and had a smoke. And the guy was with me. I had a guy with me. He says, aren't you afraid he's going to bust out? I said, if he goes, he goes. Came back in. We did all of the things. Martin told me that I had to take this guy home and get him some clothes or they could put him in a van and charge it to his bill. And I said, no, I'll take him home. I pulled up in front of his house. And I said, it's 10:23. The bus is leaving at 10:30. If you're not in, you're not going. 10:27, there he was. He said, well, you know, would you mind? We're going to take him to a place called Cry Help. He said, would you mind if we stopped and got some cigarettes? I said, well, I'll give him the Supreme test now. And I pulled around, and I said, there's the liquor store. I said, go and get your cigarettes. I can't park here. I'll circle around and catch you on the front. I circled around, and there he was. I got down to cry help. I said, well, this is your last chance out. He didn't want to take it. And that was his last day. That's his sobriety day. So you never know when it is that these things are going to happen to you. So here we are in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I need to tell you, in closing, that when I came to you people, and I don't advocate profanity, we have children in here, everyone who walked the face of the earth was an SOB. And it's amazing how you people have straightened out in the last 43 years.